Okay, so I guess I should probably get started. Hopefully people will show up. So we're covering supersymmetry, and specifically so-called n equals 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So the n equals 1 means that we have one kind of supersymmetry transformation. You can also have more than one. I discussed the algebra yesterday. But having more than one, it turns out, doesn't give you chiral fermions, Val fermions in 4 dimensions. So we're going to focus on this one because we want chiral fermions in the end. So the two representations of supersymmetry that we're going to concentrate on will be the chiral supermultiplet and the vector supermultiplet. And under supersymmetry transformations, these components all transform into each other, and these components all transform into each other. And yesterday, we spoke about how to construct supersymmetric interactions, so a supersymmetric theory. For the chiral supermultiplet, we had the standard kinetic terms. And then for interactions, we get all, the way to get supersymmetric interactions is to define a superpotential in terms of the chiral supermultiplet. And then we have essentially a recipe for expanding out in a way to generate the interactions. For the vector supermultiplet, I spoke about abelian vector supermultiplets. And in this case, the abelian vector supermultiplet on its own is non-interacting, in the sense that if you think about let's just say a pure abelian gauge field, it doesn't self-interact. But when we added charged matter, that does generate interactions. So I'll go over that again. But what I want to do before moving on is generalize the abelian vector supermultiplet to the non-abelian case. So let me just find where I am. So for a non-abelian vector field, everything has an adjoint index. And because everything in the supermultiplet should transform under the same gauge representation, under a non-abelian gauge symmetry, we want a non-abelian vector supermultiplet. And this means that our Weyl fermion component, our vector field component, and our D-term component all transform under the adjoint of a gauge group. And just in terms of nomenclature, this is obviously the vector field or the gauge field. We call this this fermion superpartner of the gauge field, the gaugino. And we call this the D-term. And in general, we say that this is a scalar, this is a Weyl fermion, and this is the F-term, for obvious reasons. So now, the action for a pure non-abelian gauge theory. Is straightforward. We just do what we usually do, where now this covariant derivative is said to be covariant with respect to the adjoint index. So in particular, our field strength, g mu nu a, is the usual d mu g nu a minus d nu g mu a plus a g FABC, G mu B, G mu C. And the D mu of lambda A is a covariant derivative with respect to the adjoint representation, which just gives a D mu lambda A minus G FABC, GB mu lambda C. So now, in this case, we can speak about the pure vector multiplet, but it has built-in self-interactions consistent with gauge invariance. And the set of interactions you get are just the minimal ones that you normally get for a minimal theory, the ones you get just for a standard non-abelian gauge theory. But now, the thing that supersymmetry forces on you is you have this Weyl fermion transforming in the adjoint, together with the vector bosons transforming the adjoint, and then the accompanying D-term. And you can show that when you apply supersymmetry transformations to this, this is invariant, and all the stuff just mixes into itself. So now let's add matter. And we spoke about adding charged matter in the abelian case. We can do the same thing in the non-abelian case. So So in the non-abelian case, we have that under gauge transformations, we have our, let's say our scalar field. Our scalar field, this also applies to the Weyl fermion field. The gauge transformation looks like this, in the sense that this is the representation that this is the generator of the representation that the field transforms under. This is the index of that representation, and in the usual way, the full transformation matrix is just the exponential with some parameter acting on the field. So the corresponding covariant derivative, in this case, is d mu phi I, which turns out to be just d mu phi I plus IG TA IJ GA mu IJ. So again, just a standard thing, in this case for the scalar component transforming under a given representation of the non-abelian gauge group. And you can do the same thing for the fermion component, and in the same way, you have d mu psi with a similar relation. So again, this is just a standard non-abelian covariant derivative. And then finally, the action for the matter then just turns into in the usual way. And then we can in principle also have a set of interactions involving these fields derived from superpotential. Okay, so actually let me just move up my brackets. Okay, so this would be the gauge invariant part for the matter fields in the usual way, but we've just promoted the regular derivatives to covariant derivatives, so this shouldn't be a surprise. This is the vector part, so this is the gauge part. But it turns out that when we mix this and that, we need to add some extra terms. And the extra terms to enforce supersymmetry turn out to have the form, and this is just like what I wrote yesterday, but generalized to the non-abelian case. Okay. And I'll just move my bracket to include this whole thing. So the set of interactions I need to add to maintain supersymmetry in the presence of this interaction, specified by the covariant derivative between the matter fields and the vector fields, turns out to be this. So this has a form, as I said yesterday, it looks like I take, let's say, my standard interaction, let's say with the fermion and the vector field, and I take two of those legs and I replace them by the superpartners. So for example, if I took this leg and turned it into a phi, and this leg and turned it into the superpartner of the A, the lambda, I would get this interaction, and so on and so forth. So these extra pieces are what you need to complete these interactions to make something that is supersymmetric. Okay, and this is just a straightforward generalization of the abelian case we spoke about yesterday. In the abelian case, what happens is the structure constants, the FABC for the gauge group, go to zero. So these interactions end up going away. You still have covariant derivatives of this form, but in the abelian case, you replace this thing by the effective charge Q of the field. So if you like, the generator for representation under the abelian group is just the charge that field has under the abelian group. And in the same way, I've replaced the TAs here by the charge, and so on and so forth. And the last thing I want to mention, so yesterday we spoke about integrating out the F terms. And the form of this, the form of the interactions that go into this interaction Lagrangian have something that looks like it looks something like F dagger of dw d phi plus the Hermitian conjugate. And when we integrate out the F terms, we get this thing squared. Essentially, the same thing happens when we integrate out the D terms. When we integrate out the D terms, there's no kinetic term here. So I can just integrate them out exactly. And what I get is the equation of motion for D is essentially dA is equal to this piece. And when I take that solution and I plug it back in, I get essentially minus 1 half dA dA, which turns into essentially this thing squared. So I take this and I put it all together. And I take this and I put it all together. And I see that my scalar potential, the set of interactions involving only scalar fields, can be written in terms of the F terms and the D terms. What I mean by that specifically is that the effective scalar potential in the theory, when I integrate out the F terms and D terms, has a form VF plus VD, which the first piece corresponds to and the second piece corresponds to 1 half dA dA. So this piece, by the equation of motion, is just F dagger. So this piece corresponds to F dagger F. This dA, by the equation of motion, corresponds to G phi dagger TA phi. So I see two things from this. First, that the scalar potential is positive semi-definite. And what I mean by that is that this potential is always greater than or equal to 0. And the only way for it to be equal to 0, which corresponds necessarily to the global minimum of its value, corresponds to both F and D vanishing. And this actually coincides with the requirement I mentioned earlier that the vacuum energy in a supersymmetric theory should vanish. Because we can write the Hamiltonian for the theory as essentially, I'll come back to this, as essentially a square of the supersymmetry generator, the supersymmetry generators. And if you want supersymmetry to respect the vacuum, it should annihilate the vacuum. And that means that so too should the Hamiltonian. So I'll come back to this and discuss it in more detail, but we're seeing this explicitly. Supersymmetry being exact is going to correspond to F and D both vanishing. So I'll come back to this and speak a bit more about it when I talk about supersymmetry breaking. But right now, I want to change gears a little bit. Let me just say a few more things about supersymmetry breaking, and then I'll take this set of formalism and apply it to the standard model and try to build a supersymmetric version of the standard model. Okay, but one thing we're seeing here, and one thing that we've seen in the minimal examples we've looked at, so we saw it in the Vestimino model yesterday, and in the tutorial you went over the SUSY QED model. In the limit of exact supersymmetry, exact supersymmetry, by exact I mean that the Lagrangian or the action is invariant under supersymmetry transformations, and that the vacuum is also invariant under supersymmetry transformations, which correspond to this. It turns out that this implies that the Hamiltonian acting on the vacuum in the supersymmetric theory should annihilate the vacuum.
The first equality should be equal to vacuum. Is it equal to zero?
it's zero. So the way to think of this is that the eigenvalue of the vacuum under the supersymmetry transformation is zero. So you want it to annihilate the vacuum. But put another way, the form of a finite supersymmetry transformation is going to have the form I to the I Q. So a finite supersymmetry transformation acting on the vacuum is going to have this form. So now if Q and Q bar annihilate the vacuum, this gives me back the vacuum. So it's just a matter of whether you're talking about the generator or the actual transformation. Yes?
Is there a super current associated with the supersymmetry transformation by adenoid?
Yeah, so I'll come back to that later on. But yeah, there is a super current. Because I'm generating a symmetry with a fermionic parameter, there's going to be some fermionicness mixed into that supercurrent, but I'll get to that later on. Okay, but in any case, the standard condition for a theory to be invariant under a symmetry, and by invariant I mean specifically without spontaneous symmetry breaking, is that a finite transformation on the vacuum should turn back should give you back the vacuum. If the finite transformation doesn't give you the vacuum and turns you into a different state, that corresponds to spontaneous symmetry breaking. So equivalent to that, equivalent to this finite transformation giving you back, leaving the vacuum invariant, this corresponds to the generators annihilating the vacuum. So I think your question, you had in mind this, whereas I was going specifically for that. But the upshot of this is I can rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of essentially a set of Qs and Q bars. And if these all annihilate the vacuum, it turns out it implies this. And if I go back to my scalar potential, the scalar potential is the thing that I minimize to find the vacuum. So for example, in the usual Higgs case, I have something that looks like this. If I think about my standard model Higgs potential, and my scalar potential is minimized here, and this tells me the vacuum state of the theory. And then because I have gauge invariance, because I have a global symmetry, I have this picture rotated around, if you like. And this spontaneously breaks the symmetry. If we apply this in a supersymmetric theory, as opposed to just a non-supersymmetric theory, in the non-supersymmetric theory, we could have added an arbitrary constant for the Higgs and move this potential up and down. What happens in supersymmetry is you actually start to care about the overall scale of the potential. And for a theory to be supersymmetric, you want the vacuum energy, the location of the minimum, to lie at zero energy, as opposed to possibly a non-zero value more generally. So in fact, a way to measure spontaneous supersymmetry breaking is to look at the scalar potential. And if the scalar potential is exactly zero, that corresponds to unbroken supersymmetry, so not spontaneously broken supersymmetry. But the thing that tells you that you have spontaneously broken supersymmetry is that this is non-zero, which means that because if this is non-zero, that would imply that you don't satisfy this. You have spontaneous breaking. And the spontaneous breaking would look like a potential, let's say that looks like this. Or maybe the potential looks like this, but all that matters is that its minimum doesn't lie at zero energy. But because of the form of the scalar potential, that's setting the form of this, for this potential not to vanish at its minimum point, this requires either a value of f or a value of d to be non-zero. So the way to check whether you have spontaneous breaking of the supersymmetry is to look for either a non-zero f term or non-zero d term. And this is actually simplifies your life, because instead of having to minimize a full scalar potential, you can instead look at the individual conditions on the F terms and the D terms and see whether it's possible for them all to vanish at the same time. Okay, so in any case, this is a story for spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. When we apply the story to the standard model, it's going to turn out that we're going to want more than just spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. We're going to want to put in explicit supersymmetry breaking. Or at least we're going to want to write down terms in our Lagrangian that look like explicit supersymmetry breaking. And I'm going to write these out now. The terms that we put in, though, when we supersymmetrize the standard model, the point of breaking supersymmetry is that we want to make sure that our particles and their superpartners are split in mass. Because if we had an electron superpartner with the same mass as the electron, we would have seen it already very easily. So we need to make sure that doesn't happen when we apply this to the standard model. And to make sure that doesn't happen, we put in supersymmetry breaking, but we put in supersymmetry breaking in such a way that it doesn't mess up this cancellation property of supersymmetry. So specifically, the terms we put in have the following form, and they're called soft. And I'll explain what I mean by soft in a minute. So the form of the soft terms is, for scalar fields, I can write down a mass term, just a regular old mass term, not related to anything else by supersymmetry. So these are terms I'm just putting in the Lagrangian that I'm not getting from a superpotential or Dieter potential. I'm just putting them in. And because I'm just putting them in general, they're going to break supersymmetry explicitly. And then I can also add so-called holomorphic soft terms. And I can put in an explicit mass for the gay genos. So these are terms that break supersymmetry, but they break supersymmetry explicitly, not spontaneously, but they break supersymmetry in a way that lets you preserve the nice cancellation property of supersymmetry. And what I mean by this is that these pieces are going to do stuff. They're going to deviate away from the form of the supersymmetric Lagrangian. So for example, this will change the mass of the scalar superfields relative to their fermion superpartners. These are new interactions that aren't necessarily captured in a superpotential. And this last piece gives you a mass to the fermion superpartner of the gauge field. It's gauge invariant in the sense that it turns out that if I contract up two adjoint indices, this gives me something that's gauge invariant. You can show this by looking at the infinitesimal transformation of an adjoint field. So this is gauge invariant. So it doesn't mess up the gauge property. But it does split the mass of the gauge genos relative to the vector bosons. So in the limit where I don't spontaneously break the gauge symmetry, the corresponding gauge bosons are massless. Whereas this is a mass term for the gauge geno superpartners that splits the masses of the things in the supermultiple. So these terms, in general, all break supersymmetry. But they all break supersymmetry in a special way. And that special way is where the soft word comes in. And what I mean by soft is that if you look at the dimensions of everything, every operator I've written down comes in with a coupling with positive mass dimension. So this is mass dimension 2. It's a mass term squared. Dimension 3, dimension 2, dimension 1, dimension 1, dimension 1. So these are all positive mass dimension couplings. And by dimensional analysis, if you think back to when we looked at, for example, a coupling of the form A phi cubed, we saw that if you go to very high energies, this A phi cubed coupling ends up becoming less and less important the higher and higher you go in energy. And the same story goes here. At energies much larger than the scale of these dimensionful couplings, and let's assume that all these dimensionful couplings have the same kind of general size, M soft. So if we assume that all these couplings, which are dimensional, have the same rough size, which we're going to designate by M soft, at energies much larger than M soft, these effects are going to become less and less important, and the theory is going to become more and more. It's going to look more and more like an exactly supersymmetric theory. So one explicit way to see this is let's look at what happens to the cancellation to the mass of some scalar field interacting with a supersymmetric theory in this sense.
Sorry, one question. Could you elaborate a little bit on this gauge invariant term? Like, is this obvious that this is gauge invariant? Because usually if you have vector potential squared, it's not, right? But this one is fermionic. Is that the reason?
Yeah, OK, so I never explicitly wrote down how these things transform under gauge transformations. So it turns out that the gauge geno superpartner just transforms like a regular field under the adjoint. whereas the gauge boson has an extra shift by a derivative. So the gauge transform, the gauge boson transforms like a usual non-abelian gauge boson, which, if you think back, transforms like something under an adjoint plus an extra derivative shift. Whereas the Gaugino, it turns out, just transforms under like a regular matter field transforming under the adjoint. And you can show that when you put in the transformation that this is gauge invariant. OK. So we put in these terms. We assume that all of these dimensionable terms have the same rough size that we label by MSoft. And you can go now and look at the cancellation between particles and superpartners from quantum corrections. Yes?
So the new terms that we've added, the phi interaction terms, are they invariant under global phase symmetry?
Yeah, OK. So here I've only written down the schematic form. But in an actual theory, we'll see this for the supersymmetric standard model, in an actual theory, these pieces should be gauge invariant. So instead of just writing a phi cubed, we're going to have multiple phis. And we're only going to put them together in gauge invariant ways. But kind of the schematic form is I'll have pieces. If I have a singlet, I can write down one thing. If I don't have singlets, I can't write that down. If I have two singlets that I can, or if I have two scalars that I can combine into something that's gauge invariant, like phi 1, phi 2, where they have they transform under opposite phases, I can write down this, and so on and so forth. So okay, at this point, this is schematic, but we'll see how this comes about in a more explicit way when we talk about the supersymmetric standard model. Okay, but just one comment. Suppose we look at a correction to some scalar field from the particles in a supermultiplet. So in general, there's going to be a loop of a fermion. So I'll call the fermion psi. And there will also be a loop. There will also be a loop of the corresponding superpartner psi. And I could do something similar for vector bosons and Gauginos. But let's look at the correction from stuff in a chiral supermultiplet, where we have in mind that these are superpartners, and the stuff we're running along here is something like a Higgs. And the usual way we're computing the change in this delta mu squared, this delta mass parameter for the Higgs field. So what we get here is something that looks, from the fermion, that looks something like minus m psi squared from the fermion piece times the couplings. And the coupling I have here is going to be some effective y psi over 4 pi squared. So the 1 over 4 pi squared comes from the loop. The y psi squared comes from the two factors of the coupling here and here. And now if I look at the scalar, the coupling here is related to this coupling by supersymmetry. So for the scalar contribution, I'm going to get something that looks like the mass of the scalar field. But the mass of the scalar field, if I had exact supersymmetry, would be the same as a fermion mass squared. But because I put in supersymmetry breaking, for example, a piece like this, or one of these other terms, I'm going to have a correction to the mass that looks like msoft squared. And then I put in the coupling factor. So this coupling factor is related to these coupling factors by supersymmetry. And it turns out that I would get the same coupling factor by supersymmetry, y psi squared over 4 pi squared. So this is my correction to this Higgs mass parameter in a supersymmetric theory where I've put in these soft supersymmetry breaking terms. And what we see is that even if we have a supersymmetric mass, m psi, that's really, really big, the part from the big supersymmetric mass here and here cancels. And what we're left over, what we're left with at the end of the day is just the soft piece. So it looks like y psi squared over 4 pi squared m soft squared.
So how is that a physical parameter then if it doesn't show up in the observables? I mean, can we observe this mass at some point?
Oh, yeah. So we could still measure it in principle if we had enough energy to make the heavy states.
Yeah, but for the time being, you need to be arbitrarily high, right? So it's is it just closing the eyes? I mean, just saying basically, we solve this fine-tuning problem by assuming that these masks represent the same, so they cancel exactly. So, how is this? Is this really way better than the problem that we had before, the hierarchy problem?
But remember, so what we're going to do in a second is take this and apply it to the standard model. And in the standard model, we also consider loops of the standard model states. And that means that for either one or the other, we know what this is, and it's not too big. So for the standard model things and the superpartners, the corresponding corrections from those things, by embedding them in a supersymmetric theory, will mean that this thing can't be too big, in fact. So this thing can't be too big. This thing can't be too big. More generally, if I looked at the divergence structure, so I haven't drawn the divergence structure. I've just shown the leftover pieces. But if I did the divergence structure here, this fermion piece would also have a lambda squared from the cutoff. This piece would also have a lambda squared from the cutoff, but those would also cancel. So okay, it comes down to how you want to think about the problem. But the point is that when I embed this thing into a supersymmetric theory, whether this is big or not, you get a cancellation between this piece and this piece with a remainder given by the soft mass. So what's happening is we're seeing that you still get the if you break supersymmetry explicitly with these soft terms, you still get the supersymmetric cancellation up to the energy scale set by M soft. So because we have an inexact cancellation, this could still be big if M soft is very large. But numerically, it's about the right size. It's about the same size as the natural Higgs mass squared parameter, provided the MSoft parameter is not too much larger than about a TeV. So this is a motivation to have supersymmetry near the weak scale. That the supersymmetric cancellation works to a reasonable extent, essentially no matter what kind of matter we put into our theory, as long as the soft breaking of supersymmetry is not too big. That corresponds to the soft scale being less than about a TeV. And now if we take the standard model, embed it in a supersymmetric theory, and put in the soft terms, this says that we should expect to see superpartners with masses on the order of a TeV if supersymmetry is going to do the thing we want it to do. So this is the motivation for supersymmetry at the weak scale. You get this nice cancellation. Putting in soft terms lets you split the particle masses and their superpartners. So this is what we need to explain why we haven't seen the superpartners yet. But at the same time, the superpartners can't be arbitrarily heavy, for the standard model states at least, because otherwise the supersymmetric cancellation doesn't work anymore. So the next thing we want to do is take the story and apply it to the standard model, and take the standard model and embed it in a supersymmetric theory.
Is there any kind of experimental bound for the M soft? Like we cannot estimate M soft, so capital one, but can we estimate M soft should be like, can we experimentally give some bound for the M soft? Like it should not be some value or not.
Okay, well so experimentally we can say that M soft has to be larger than a certain number, because otherwise we would have seen the superpartners already. On the other hand, as M soft becomes bigger and bigger, supersymmetry stops giving you the cancellation that you want it to. So on the lower end, you have this experimental constraint. On the high end, you have the, if you like, the theoretical motivation that you want that you want your new physics to come in and cancel off this UV sensitivity. So the motivation from above is the cancellation, which is the whole motivation for supersymmetry in this context anyhow. No, if M soft is at the TeV scale, and you put in the loop correction, the net thing is about 100 GeV squared, and this is the same size as the value we see for the Higgs mass parameter in the standard model. So this corresponds essentially to the largest possible natural value for the soft mass. As you start making the soft mass bigger than that, the correction becomes bigger than the thing we want to get at the end of the day. And to get the 100 GeV squared at the end of the day, you have to have some kind of cancellation that you don't necessarily expect. But it's perfectly OK for the correction to be the same size as the thing you want to find, because at least you're in the right ballpark. Whereas if your correction is, I don't know, like 10 to the 20 times larger, you're not in the right ballpark at all.
If we introduce that soft term explicitly, like we are always having like not like supersymmetry can never be exact in any higher energy, high energy scale, then like how can we why do we like how can we confirm the supersymmetry from experiment like by observing the new particle threat?
Yeah, okay, so there are two parts to that. So first of all, if your only supersymmetry breaking is soft, that means that asymptotically, as you go to higher and higher energies, supersymmetry becomes a better and better approximation. Because all the corrections, all the non-supersymmetric corrections are suppressed by factors of essentially the energy over the soft scale. So asymptotically, supersymmetry becomes better and better. The other thing, though, and this is the picture that is probably good to have in mind, these soft terms are things that, in your low energy effective theory, look like explicit breaking of supersymmetry. But sort of morally, we expect them to come from some sort of spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. So the picture we have, the picture that's good to have in the back of your mind is that at some kind of fairly high energy or moderate energy, well above the weak scale, supersymmetry is broken spontaneously. And the effects of that spontaneous breaking generate these effective soft terms in the low energy effective theory. So from the low energy effective theory point of view, it looks like you have explicit supersymmetry breaking, but of a special so-called soft type. But in the full theory, supersymmetry is still exact, but it's spontaneously broken. But the thing you'd expect from this story is that all the standard model states, if your theory is ultimately supersymmetric, your standard model states should have superpartners. And that's a thing that we're motivated to find. And because we have this argument that the soft scale shouldn't be too big if you want a natural weak scale, that motivates looking for standard model superpartners at energies near the TEV scale. So in particular, looking for them at the LHC. OK, so the thing I want to do now is take the standard model and embed it into supersymmetry. So if you think about the stuff in the standard model, we have fermions. And in particular, we have left-handed fermions. We have right-handed fermions. We have vector bosons. And we have the Higgs field. So we want to take these different kinds of things in the standard model and embed them within supermultiplets. So it's going to turn out that these fermions, the matter fermions, the left and right-handed quarks and leptons, we're going to put into chiral supermultiplets. The Higgs, we're going to put into a chiral supermultiplet. And the vector bosons, we're going to put into a vector supermultiplet. Not surprising. The other thing, though, is that in the standard model, we usually talk about left-handed fermions and right-handed fermions. For this supersymmetric language, because we formulate it in terms of chiral supermultiplets, it's going to be more convenient to formulate the standard model fermion representations in terms of entirely left-handed spinners. And I'll get to how that works. So let's start with the fermion fields. So for each generation, so we have three generations, but for each generation, we have we have a Q multiplet, which is an SU2 doublet with the SU2 components up and down. Under SU3, its gauge quantum numbers are 3, 2, and 1/6. So it's a 3 under SU3. It's a doublet under SU2, and its hypercharge is 1/6. And from this, we get the left and right-handed the left and right-handed quarks. We get one from each generation, and there are three generations of this. So we're going to take this, and we're going to embed this into a supermultiplet. So the name of the supermultiplet is going to be Q. So people tend to reuse notation. And the elements of the supermultiplet are going to be a Q tilde, a Q, and an F sub Q. So this is OK. There are a lot of Qs here, but what's going on is we use Q to denote the full supermultiplet. But we also use Q to denote the fermion component. And this is a notation that I'm very used to. Sometimes people put little hats on the supermultiplets to distinguish them as supermultiplets as opposed to component fields. In practice, people don't tend to use hats, but I'll try to put hats on for now. So here's my supermultiplet. Everything within the supermultiplet transforms this way under the standard model gauge groups. So we've taken the standard model quark doublet that transforms like this, and we've embedded into a Carl superfield. And the components of this thing are up left and down left quarks, and the components of this scalar superpartner, because remember it's a Carl supermultiplet, so these are vile fermions, and these are our complex scalars. We're going to denote them by up left and down left with little squiggles. So the little tilde, little squiggle, denotes the fact that it's a scalar superpartner of the corresponding fermions. So these are the things you know and love from the standard model. These are the new superpartners. And the name we give to these is we call these squarks. So like quarks, but with an S. I didn't invent the terminology. So this works for Q. And I can do the same thing for the lepton doublet. So for L, in the standard model, I have nu L, EL. And this thing transforms as a 1, 2, minus 1 half. So corresponding to this, we'll embed it into a supermultiplet L with components L tilde. Sorry, let me just write this a bit lower. With components L tilde, L, and F sub L. And as before, this is nu L EL. And as before, this is nu L. And we call these sleptons, or if you like, a sneutrino and a selectron. Right, anyway, you just put an S on. Okay, you see where it's coming from. OK, but in any case, we're taking our happy standard model supermultiplets, and we're turning them into chiral supermultiplets in supersymmetry. This is straightforward. OK, so we've gone through all of our left-handed multiplets. Let's go to the right-handed states. So in the standard model, we know that we have a right-handed up quark, u right. And this transforms as a 3, 1, 2/3. So this is a right-handed spinner. So if I go off and I write my two-component index notation, this is going to correspond to ur alpha dot. And if you recall, I can, given a right-handed spinner, I can form a left-handed spinner by conjugating and lowering the index. So I can form my notation here was a u bar r alpha, which I can define this as epsilon alpha beta ur alpha dot star. Sorry, it should be a beta dot. So remember, the rule we had was you take this, you conjugate it, and then you lower the index. And this gives you a standard left-handed spinner. OK, so motivated by this, because we want to put this into a supermultiplet with a left-handed spinner component, we call the corresponding supermultiplet UC. So here, the C is just part of the name. And sometimes people use bars instead of Cs, but I think the C is a bit more common. And the components of this are going to be tilde UC, UC, F sub UC. And what I mean by this is this UC is the name that I give for this object. So the C here is just part of the name. And it's a left-handed spinner. And it's a left-handed spinner component of this U hat C supermultiplet. I also have a corresponding U tilde C. U tilde C scalar superpartner, scalar up quark. And sometimes people also write this. OK, so this gets a bit confusing. Sometimes people also write this as UR tilde star. And the reason for the UR tilde star is that if you look at how this transforms under gauge transformations, this object corresponds to what's essentially the complex conjugate of the UR, the right-handed up quark field. So if I conjugate this, instead of transforming under a 3, it'll transform under a 3 bar. It'll still be a singlet under SU2, but its hypercharge will be minus 2/3. So the gauge quantum numbers of this are 3 bar, 1, minus 2/3. And the motivation for this is because this thing has hypercharge, for example, minus 2/3. And that means that U tilde R star has hypercharge minus 1/3. So if we complex conjugate this, we get U tilde R, which has hypercharge plus 1/3. And we can identify U tilde R with the superpartner of the right-handed up quark. OK, so we've done a bit of jumping through hoops. It might take a little bit of staring to get used to this. But the point of it is that we take these things that we usually write in terms of right-handed spinners in the standard model, we convert them into, we write them in terms of essentially their conjugates, which correspond to left-handed spinners. We put that into a chiral supermultiplet with a complex scalar component, a left-handed fermion component, and an F term. And this left-handed fermion component, if you like, is a complex conjugate of the right-handed up quark. And the little c here, again, is part of the name, just to let you know that there's sort of some conjugation involved. But the C doesn't actually represent the conjugation operation. It's just part of the name. This is a slightly funny convention. And the reason we have to do these contortions is that somebody decided to write down the standard model with upright quarks. Instead, we could have spoken about, we could have also formulated the standard model entirely in terms of left-handed spinners. And that would have been fine as well. But historically, people did in terms of right-handed things. In any case, we have our Q multiplet. So we have the Q multiplet. We have the L multiplet. We have our UC multiplet. The other multiplets to put in for the matter fields are DC. And this is going to be D tilde C, DC, FDC. And this is a 3 bar 1 plus 1/3, because again, it corresponds to the conjugate of the right-handed state. So 3 goes to 3 bar, and minus 1/3 goes to plus 1/3. And then I have E hat C, which which is a 1, 1, plus 1. And it's a plus 1 because the corresponding right-handed electron has hypercharge minus 1. But this thing corresponds, if you like, to its conjugate to get a left-handed piece. So this is our set of matter fields. We have these 5 chiral supermultiplets that match up with the standard model counterparts. The next thing we want to get are the vector boson fields and the Higgs field.
What about the right-handed retrieval?
At least within the standard model, strictly defined, there's no right-handed neutrino. But if I wanted to put in a right-handed neutrino, I could also add a new, n-hat supermultiplet. N-hat C supermultiplet, where the things in the n-hat C supermultiplet would be a singlet sneutrino, a singlet conjugate of the right-handed neutrino, and an F term. So I could put that in exactly the same way within a chiral supermultiplet. But that's typically something we consider beyond the standard model, so I won't get into that. So these are our matter fields. We can also put in the Higgs. The Higgs, it turns out, has a slight complication. So we'll see why in a second. But it turns out for the Higgs, we actually need two chiral supermultiplets. We call these Higgs up and Higgs down. And the chiral supermultiplets that we put the Higgs in have the components Higgs up, Higgs tilde up, F Higgs up, and Higgs down, Higgs tilde down, F Higgs down. And this transform is like a 1, 2, plus 1 half. And this is a 1, 2, minus 1 half. And if you look at what I've done here, compared to the matter fields, I've put a tilde on a different place. So the tilde on the different place corresponds to the fact that the standard model part of these multiplets corresponds to the scalar thing. And we're already used to writing Higgs without a tilde. So now we use the tilde to denote the superpartner. And the superpartners in this case are left-handed vial fermions. And we call them Higgsinos. Sorry. So again, this is more terminology that I didn't invent. But OK, so now we have two Higgs doublets. And I'll explain why we need this in a second. And their superpartners, the fermionic Higgsinos, which are left-handed fermions. OK, so it turns out that these are all the chiral supermultiplets that we need for the standard model when we supersymmetrize it. The last thing we need to do is put in vector supermultiplets for the gauge fields. And this is straightforward to do. I think there's a That's not what I wanted.
There's a manual option which allows you to individually move the boards. On the right.
Oops. Oh, yeah. No, I was just trying to be fancy and do it all at once. OK. I'll stick with manual. Nope. OK, that's what I wanted. OK, so for the vector supermultiplets, we're going to need three of them. So the first vector supermultiplet, this is the easiest one, is the hypercharged supermultiplet. And its components are going to be b0, b mu, and d. Okay, I'll write it as d sub b. And this is a hypercharged gauge field multiplet. And its standard model quantum numbers are going to be, it's a singlet under SU3, a singlet under SU2, and has zero hypercharge. So it's a complete singlet. This thing is sometimes called the Bino. So it's a gauge Eno for the B multiplet, so we call it the Bino. OK, now I'll put hats on just to. So for the SU2 multiplet, we have oops, it should be a D. OK, so for the SU2 multiplet, we have the we have the three-component W mu field. If you think back to the standard model, this thing mixes into the photon and the Z and the W plus minus. And this thing has, it's a triplet under SU2 and has zero hypercharge. And it's a singlet under SU3. And finally, we have, OK, and then we call this the Wino. And finally, we have the color supermultiplet. And this is a adjoint under SU3, a singlet under SU2, and it has no hypercharge. So it's an adjoint under SU3, which is an 8. And this object we call the gluino. So it's the superpartner of the gluon. Okay. And we can also assign baryon and lepton number to all these things. And we can also assign something called R charge, but I'll come back and get to that later. So what we're going to do with all these fields is write down a supersymmetric Lagrangian. The gauge interactions are all fixed by the gauge quantum numbers. So we take our regular derivatives, we turn them into gauge covariant derivatives, we add the extra pieces you need for supersymmetric invariants, and that's all fixed. The only thing left to specify, after specifying what these matter fields are, and after specifying what the matter fields are and what the gauge interactions are, which are essentially fixed by gauge invariant supersymmetry, are the Yukawa interactions. And the Yukawa interactions are going to give us a regular standard model of Yukawa interactions, but also some mass terms. And for those, we're going to get them from a superpotential. And let me say that this supersymmetrization of the standard model, this is the minimal possible one, and it's usually called the MSSM. So the minimal supersymmetric standard model. We can write down we can write down superpotential terms that will give us Yukawa terms. So for example, so this piece doesn't give us Yukawa terms. This piece is going to give us a mass term for the Higgs. But the Yukawa terms are going to come from stuff that looks like Q So just two comments about this. This hu.hd corresponds to the dot here means I'm connecting up the SU2 indices with an epsilon tensor. So specifically, hu has an SU2 index I'll call I. Hd has an SU2 index I'll call j. And we're contracting these up with an epsilon ij. And for SU2, epsilon ij is an invariant tensor. So in general, for an SUn, you have an epsilon ijk, blah, 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 up to n, and a delta ij is your invariant tensors. For SU2, I happen to have the 2nx1, so this turns out to be SU2 invariant. And if I write this out, if I look at my components of HU, and I match up how they what their electric charges should be, it turns out that the hypercharge, that the two SU2 components of HU, when I connect up their hypercharges with the SU2 quantum number, remember that our electric charge is the T3 plus hypercharge. So the total hypercharge of the multiplet is 1/2, and the T3 is plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. So here, this is the T3 of this is plus 1/2, the T3 of this is minus 1/2. So the total electric charge of this is plus, and the total electric charge of that is minus. We can also write down the SU2 components of HD. Okay, if you like. And here the upper component is 0, and the lower component is minus when I expand it in terms of SU2 components. But the upshot of this is that this thing, when I expand it with SU2 components, corresponds to HU plus, HD minus, minus HU0, HD0. And we see that everything's nicely at least invariant under electromagnetism. And you can show more generally that it's invariant under hypercharge and SU2. So the SU2 part comes from contracting the epsilons. The hypercharge invariance comes from the fact that this is plus 1/2, this is minus 1/2, so the whole total hypercharge is 0. And this is all consistent with electric charge conservation as well. These pieces are going to give us our standard model Yukawa couplings. So in particular, I'm going to have one of these for each generation. Or actually, even more complicated than this, I'm going to have a whole Yukawa set with all three generations. But for now, let's just look at this form. One thing we see, though, is from this, we can see why we need both Higgs multiplets. And the reason for two Higgs multiplets is that recall that the superpotential has to be holomorphic in the sense that it can depend on the superfields, but not their conjugates. And here, I can combine my Q with an HU to give me something that, and UC to give me something that's gauge invariant. But there's no hypercharge. If I only had the HU, there would be no hypercharge combination that could connect up the D the d with the q to give me the corresponding down Yukawa or the corresponding electron Yukawa. So the only way to get gauge invariant things, if I'm not allowed to complex conjugate, is to have a second Higgs doublet. What you do in the standard model, where you have one Higgs doublet, is at least either in this term, you define this like H tilde, which is essentially a conjugated Higgs, and that lets you contract up that lets you contract up everything with one Higgs. But now, because we have because we have to impose holomorphy on the superpotential, we're not allowed to do that, so we need two Higgs multiplets. Just one last comment. These SU2 indices are also connected up with the epsilon ij. So this thing is going to correspond to the upper component of this, which would be UL and the lower component of this, HU0 minus DL H plus U. Which you can check that this thing, when I combine it with this thing, gives me something that has that's electrically neutral. And then I can do the same connections here and the same connections here. OK, so I'm out of time. But I'll come back to this tomorrow. But the upshot is that we're going to be able to get all the interactions we want for the standard model, in particular all the Yukawa interactions from these things. This thing is going to turn into a mass parameter for the Higgs. And then we're going to get other stuff that's forced upon us by supersymmetry that will give us new interactions between standard model states and the superpartners. So let me wrap it up there, but see you tomorrow.